I made a very interesting discovery. Most of the great priests of the Hopi, Navajo, Zuni groups of peoples were like the prophets of the Old Testament. They revealed the will of the deities. They perpetuated a certain set doctrine or documentary process, which they preserved through their sand paintings, their kachinas, and their various ritual dances. These ancient procedures began, we do not know how long ago, but certainly at least 1,000 years. And until very recently, the life of the tribes was built upon these procedures, these doctrines. And the whole summary of it is that a doctrine that had come from the past was accepted without question, and its procedures were followed, and its ceremonies were kept. And these obediences constituted religion. Religion was therefore an obedience to a kind of arbitrary code of unknown origin, which had been carried forward, sanctified, and accepted. In the last 25 or 30 years, a number of young people have come up in these villages. Many of them have found it profitable to continue the arts and crafts of their ancestors. They work in turquoise and in silver. They also still weave a few blankets. They make various native drawings and symbols on wood or cardboard, representing the deities of old on the kachina masks. These are beautifully done and have a very ready sale, and along with pottery and baskets, constitute a major source of income. Also, these modern works are expensive. Now, what has happened? Somewhere along the line, these younger people began to interpret their own beliefs. Up to that time, no one had interpreted them. They had accepted them. But the young people on the reservations now are talking in terms of Zen and extrasensory perception. They are discussing Oriental philosophies, and they are incorporating into their work evidences of a new interpretive value which was not previously present. Now, the difference seems to have been caused not only by contact with outside sources and greater educational opportunities, but by the inevitable needs of these people. These native tribes and people are very intelligent. They are thoughtful, they are patient, but they are intelligent. And in the course of time, it has dawned upon many of these that it was not only necessary to perpetuate the old doctrines with great care, but it was necessary to adapt the old to the needs of the new. And this is called interpretation. Now, interpretation did not begin on the mesas of the American Southwest. Interpretation has existed everywhere, and interpretations are frequently reinterpreted a number of times because of the changing pressures of circumstances and the unfolding needs of the individual. The individual of today who is thoughtful cannot accept without question the literalisms of ancient believing. He cannot simply be satisfied to listen to the patriarchs of old and accept without question anything that they reported or regarded as significant. Perhaps the main separating factor was the gradual unfoldment within the individual of the realization that he had the power to think. Very primitive tribes, and probably our cave ancestors, did not have very extensive intellectual equipment. Therefore, they depended upon their priests and their leaders for all of their wisdom. And these, in turn, depended upon a mysterious order of beings called the gods. And the gods were the parents of the tribes and the clans. The gods made all the decisions. The gods saved man. The gods cursed man. The gods hardened the hearts of the pharaohs, and he also answered prayers for rain and fecundity. The god of the tribe was the master, the autocrat, the absolute ruler. And the people, in all emergencies, turned to him. And descending from this line of thinking gradually over a period of time, we come to medieval Europe and medieval Asia, in which the divine right of kings was merely a transference of the god image to the ruling monarch. But with one mysterious spiritual power responsible for everything, and this power subject to a variety of moods, so the deities became angry and petulant. They developed rather unfortunate moral complications. It became perhaps a little difficult for the believer to have full confidence in deities as these were recorded in mythology with their curious behaviorisms. So gradually, the unfolding intelligence of the individual made a very important discovery. He began to examine himself. He began to search for his own place in the plan of things. He wished to experience something of individuality, of identity. He wanted to have something to say about his future and how he was going to change society according to his own feelings. The deities remained, but they were more or less distant, and gradually many of their powers were taken over by the people themselves. And out of this began what we like to term today the concept of mysticism. Mysticism was the transference of the leadership of life from outside factors to internal powers. The individual began to realize that there was within himself a capacity for growth, for unfoldment, for maturity, for enrichment. That he also had something to say about what he should believe and what he should not believe. But most of all, he wanted to know more about what he believed. He did not wish to accept merely a statement because it came from an authority. And gradually, the seat of authority was moved from the heavens to his own mind. And his own thinking became the basis of his judgments and his decisions. Now, this process occurred largely in that period which we call classical history. The process of gradually transferring the rulership of the universe from mysterious abstract deities and placing this responsibility upon individuals, upon human beings, making them not only masters of their own souls, but also obligated to themselves for standards of conduct and for moral directives. The moment the individual began to experience the richness of his own inner life, he began to explore more carefully. And of course, even today, with all of our instruments of research, we are still not able to fully understand the internal life of the human being. But we have a realization that there's something there that we can see every day and that we can experience every day that can become much more real to us than some group of deities on high Olympus. So little by little, man took over the world, took over the universe, and most of all, took over his own life. When he did this, it became important for him to look around for landmarks, to find something to build his new way of life upon. It finally occurred to him that the old way wasn't bad, that the golden rules and the Ten Commandments were reasonably solid, and that it was going to be very difficult to undermine them. It therefore came about that the individual continued to accept the revelations of his sacred prophets and sacred books, but began the process of interpreting them, to bring them into focus with his current need, to gradually transform or transfer the old doctrine to his own psychic life, so that he could become, in a sense, the master of his own destiny. Probably the most important period in the transference of this pattern was that which occurred between the 2nd century B.C. and the 3rd century A.D., so far as Europe and even most of Asia are concerned. At that time, there was in Alexandria, Ephesus, Antioch, and a number of other centers of caravan routes, a polyglot culture developing. People of many beliefs assembled there to trade and barter, and in many instances to communicate the choicest secrets of their moral lives. Therefore, we have an opportunity presented to the citizens of these communities to select the things they would believe. They had many opportunities. Some stranger from far away brought an interesting idea, and the Greek or the Egyptian or the Semite decided it was pretty good, so he took it and put it into his faith. Another came from a different locality with some scientific discovery, some religious conviction, and others in Antioch or Ephesus thought that was pretty good and saw how it fitted into their own belief. And as a result, they built it in to their own belief. This process is continuing even today. And nearly every student of comparative religion working today is seeking to find what is useful to him out of the religions of the world and create his own faith based upon the recognition of his own need in the terms of the available solutions. Little by little, this procedure went on until it became obvious that the old idea that progress was bestowed by deities, that changes were the result of mutations beyond human control, this changed to the idea that new attitudes, new realizations, new stratagems of intelligence could come from within the person, that the great oracle was perhaps his own heart. He knew that it was the center of his life, but he had never really made it the center of his philosophy of life. He knew that he had a mind that could help him to form various implements, make pottery, weave cloth, do beadwork. Also that this mind enabled him to travel in various places, enabled him to gradually discover certain secrets of health, and to defend himself against his enemies. All this coming from his own mind gradually changed his point of view. He no longer prayed to the Olympian deities to save him from trouble. He sought inside himself for the remedy to his own problem. The result is what we call mysticism. Mysticism is nothing more nor less than the transference of the supreme power from some outside source to an internal source. Now, mysticism did not deny the outside source. Mysticism did not destroy the gods or condition them adversely. Mysticism pointed out the important point that the gods that we worship in the sky are inside of ourselves, that the divine power at the base of all things animates each living thing, that it is not necessary to search on some distant mountain in order to be close to deity. It was only necessary to recognize the divinity in your own heart. Paul very clearly stated this in his establishment of what might be termed the Messianic Christianity. Christ in you, the hope of glory. Mysticism has been built on the indwelling divinity. It has been built upon the concept that it is only an indwelling divinity that can legitimately and justly administer creation. We tried very hard to get used to the idea that God wandered about and carefully checked every human being as to his orthodoxy and his morality. Deity watched every move of every human being, and from this came to certain decisions as to whether this individual was worthy of being saved or not. Gradually, this thing we call the mind, working with this problem, found it extremely difficult to rationalize. The idea of what were called the Azonic deities, deities that had no abode in time or place, but were always and everywhere. This was becoming a difficult thing to understand. But the moment the individual accepts that within himself, in his own heart, is the judge and jury that will regulate his conduct, this is quite different. Then the God in him can watch his every action day and night. And the God in his neighbor will do the same thing for his neighbor. And it became impossible to conceive of an error, a false judgment, or a confusion, because everything became a direct relationship with the person committing or performing an action. This type of thinking gradually resulted in the rise of a magnificent system of religious philosophy that flourished in North Africa at about the beginning of the Christian era. Here, various systems came together, each one bringing with it the choicest elements of its own beliefs. Here in Alexandria, Hinduism flourished. Here, Buddhism had its stronghold. Here, the doctrines of Persia, of all the Babylonian and Chaldean empires, found rooting. Here also, early Christianity and Judaism became part of the daily life of the people. And out of this complex of beliefs, there arose a system of philosophy which is perhaps best defined as Neoplatonism, in which all wisdom was explored and interpreted in terms of interior experience. All things had to be solved from within the believer. The answer was not to be found outside. If he thought he got the answer from the outside, it was because the internal faculties of his own consciousness bestowed it, but it seemed to be separate from his ordinary cognitions. So everyone in those days recognized that each religion, whether it was Buddhism or Semitism or whatever it might be, had found it necessary to develop a mysticism. It had to have it because it was impossible to hold the minds of people to a completely literal revelation. It was impossible to prevent the mind from growing, and that which had been acceptable before the mind developed was no longer acceptable after the mental processes were available. So the individual took the old beliefs and, with the aid of his mind, brought them into a contemporary focus for his own use, making it possible for him to find the solution to his inner experiences from the world's structure of knowledge. One of the answers to this, of course, comes in a division that took place between what we call today idealism and materialism. Idealism was an interpretation of nature in the terms of a loving deity or a universal process essentially benevolent. Materialism was the denial of this, and the emphasis was upon simply accidental or providential incidents, and the individual never had any foundation whatsoever for confidence in the universe to which he belonged. This difference of opinion created schools of interpretation. Modern science is largely based upon the materialistic interpretation, and modern religion upon the idealistic, and modern philosophy is, so to say, in a state of deadly confusion between the two. No one seems to know in philosophy just what to do about these things. But philosophy, to be of importance and significance, must gradually verge toward idealism, because it must recognize a legitimate reason for the occurrences of life. Failure to do this makes philosophy a dead end as far as a contribution to human progress could be concerned. Now, in the beginning of this Neoplatonic tradition, we find Platonism, Pythagoreanism, all of these schools of thought coming in together to create a new concept, namely the concept of the open door back to reality. If the God in man is part of a supreme being, a fragment of the eternal, then the answer to the human problem is for this fragment to return to that of which it is a part. And the God in each has the power, the authority, and the means to restore its identity with the God of all. Thus, there was the need for the development of a means of increasing internal culture. The ancients were just as aware as we are of the dangers of war. They realized that petty nuisances flourished all over the earth. They knew of the corrupt rulers and the corrupted peoples. They knew of exploitation, of war, and of all the difficulties that beset us. I remember noting that in the Code of Hammurabi of Babylon, one of the earliest of all codes to govern conduct, there was a long and complete section dealing what to do with home builders who shoddied the materials. And when the house fell down, the law stepped in and really made an issue of it. And that was thousands of years ago. So the problems have not changed too much, except perhaps they've become a little more numerous and a little more forceful. But in the problems themselves, the great question was to find a solution. And here, these mystics, recognizing the need for a program of forwardness, began to organize their concepts of the future. The Sibyls prophesied the times to come. The prophets and sages and philosophers contemplated the philosophic empire. And religions meditated upon the mystery of the second coming and the New Jerusalem. These were interpretations. They were expansions, extensions, based upon the need of certain advancements by persons who could not survive under the conditions of the old order of things. This means that the mystics worked in very many different ways, not only to plan a future, but if possible, to learn how to build together for a definite goal. In this cycle of things, we had all kinds of appearances rise over the horizon. Nearly every religion developed an esoteric section. It developed a group within itself which was able to clearly integrate available knowledge and focus it upon the shape of things to come. The sage no longer contemplated things as they are. He began to think of things as they must become through the active effort of intelligence. The sage began not only to believe in honesty, but to realize from experience the tragedies of dishonesty. It was no longer an empirical believing. It was no longer the Ten Commandments shouted from the tops of Sinai. Now it was experience, the individual living in a world which broke the rules and suffered, and the philosopher contemplating the possibility of keeping the rules and in this way transcending suffering and establishing a better world. These thoughts developed in a number of ways, but the essential point of the whole mysticism of the early Christian period was that it was possible for the human being, because of a deity in himself, to unfold every virtue necessary for his enlightenment. It was not necessary to assume that there had to be some divine intercession. There only had to be the release of the eternal divine from within the person himself. Now, how was this release to be accomplished? It's obvious that, in a way, it is happening all the time. The release of the inner life of the person is through experience. By experience, we ultimately learn what is good and what is bad. We may topple empires, destroy races, and overwhelm civilizations, but ultimately we will learn what is right from experience. But it is a long and painful journey. It therefore occurred to some of these people, the more enlightened of them certainly, that it was possible to achieve a greater leadership in the control of experience, that it was possible to find what the alchemist said, that art can perfect nature. In other words, that there was an art of living that could be studied, could be learned, and could be achieved, and was just as real and just as useful as any academic course that the person could take. Gradually it became obvious that academics could teach the individual to use the world as he knew it, but mysticism could help him to change the world. And we have always, in our time especially, regretted the conservative attitude of academic knowledge. Instead of leading, it is clinging desperately to the old procedures and struggling to maintain a prestige that is in most instances outworn. But in the mystical processes of things, the front door is always open. There is always the possibility of progress, of growth. Art can perfect nature. There must be an art of perfecting man. There has to be a science of salvation. There has to be a real, organized, factual road that leads from the present state of the individual to the fulfillment and unfoldment of his entire body of potentials, of inner capacities, of abilities, long locked. Many persons are not even aware that they possess these abilities, but nevertheless they are there. And every individual has the seed of perfection within himself. Out of this kind of thinking came a series of organized movements in early religion. One of these was the Hermetic tradition of Egypt, the mysterious philosophy of Hermes Trismegistus, the thrice great Hermes. the founder of a great system which gradually mingled itself with Gnosticism. It was here also that alchemy had its beginning, for alchemy was nothing more than a science of art perfecting nature. Here came the Kabbalah to help to release the mind from the jots and tittles of Scripture and allow the inner life of the individual to fulfill the law which these Scriptures required. Here was also astrology, which was originally a psychology of the universe. It was a way of interpreting the universe as an organism, as a living thing. It was a psychological entity, whereas astronomy was merely a physiological entity as far as the heavens were concerned. And the ancient systems of Ptolemaic astrology became a clue to the unfoldment of man, and astrology became a factor in the development of the healing arts. It became a factor in government. Almost every field that wanted an organized plan for development began to copy the structure of the solar system, which was to them the largest complete entity available to them. So everywhere and all down through the centuries, this process of building a way out of the labyrinth dominated a certain group of persons. It came as a series of experiences. And as the early church fathers pointed out, most of the experiences that brought about enlightenment were sad. They were experiences of grief or loss or frustration. They were something within the individual, a kind of moral sense that accused him of his own misdeeds. They were limitations and restrictions which he had to throw off in order to go on with the purpose for which he was intended. In your early Christian church, you had a strong mysticism, of which perhaps the outstanding example was St. Francis de Assis. We had in him a person who had a mystical appreciation, acceptance, and participation in the total mystery of existence. And this mystery experience came from within himself. It was a light within himself, which cast a glow upon everything outside of himself and enabled him to read the world by the light of his own soul. There have been many mystics, not only in Christianity and Judaism, but also in other countries. The mystics of Islam were very interesting and very dramatic in their interpretation of a combination of Semitic and Christian philosophy. In Asia, the secret sciences of yoga and Vedanta arose out of the desperate determination to accomplish what we find in one of the quatrains of the Rubaiyat, where the poet is made to say, "From my base metal shall be filed the key that shall unlock the door he howls without," referring to the dervishes. From our base metal must be filed this key, for it is only in ourselves and in our own substances that this key can exist. No one can give us the key. No one can open the door for us. But we can learn from each other how to be more and more worthy of receiving the key. And having received it, become sufficiently insightful to know how to turn it in the lock. And in the Kabbalah, it is said it must be turned 7 times to open the mysteries of the faith. So we have the gradual developing of a supernatural, superphysical mysticism, which, however, did not have that strange aloofness that we found in the old supernatural mythologies and theologies. It was no longer deities seated upon their Merus or their Olympic heights. The mysterious depth of things went inward, and man's inner universe became a primary object of concern. Along the way, of course, it became interesting and important to try to understand man. And so the individual used his mind and turned it in upon itself. He turned the brain in upon the mind and the mind in upon the functions of its own existence. And gradually, through the effort to understand his own mind, the human being came up with a series of divergent solutions. Some of these are now incorporated into modern psychology. Many of them are also now parts of religious structures. The study of the constitution of man and how he functions gradually took on a cosmic coloring. Many mystics saw in their own natures keys to the universal nature. They saw in the functions of their own bodies the miniatures of the functions of the great bodies in space. They fulfilled the Hermetic axiom, as above, so below. That which is true of the greatest is true of the least. And that which is true of the cosmos and the galaxy is true of the tiniest gnat floating in a sunbeam. Everything is part of a great lawfulness. This lawfulness is not revealed directly by deities. It is experienced by the person himself. And in this process of experiencing, we have another step that is very important. Most ancient peoples were accused of idolatry. They were supposed to be out worshipping wood and stone. They were said to be completely dominated by these inert manufacturings of their own skills, and that they were praying to something they could never answer and to which they gave a false allegiance. This began another step in the study of this matter, and it gradually dawned upon most of these peoples, many of them at least, that these deities that they had previously considered to be persons and had represented by imagery were really not persons and could not be adequately represented by any form of imagery. These persons were merely the symbolical appearances of principles eternal in space. And if an image was created, this image stood for a principle and not for a personality. It did not represent an angry God who was going to punish his people. It did not represent any power or authority such as we know. This personification represented an aspect of the total life, the total network of interacting truths, principles, realities by which the universe is sustained. So little by little, the individual got over idolatry and began to realize that idolatry belonged to the idea that things came from the outside rather than from the inside. After the beginning of the Christian era, we find that Christianity inevitably and instinctively moved toward the idea of salvation through merit. The entire structure was geared to the realization that man must, in some way or other, discover the inward workings of the divine plan. The New Testament and parts of the Old Testament consider the matter of prayer very carefully. And nearly all of those who have studied the situation carefully realize that prayer was a form of meditation, of concentration, a means of retiring into the self in science, in silence and in solitude, in order to search out the self that is locked within us. The prayer is addressed to God, but the ear that hears it is the God in our own hearts, the ear that is in the heart symbol of the Egyptian philosophy. Thus, the prayer can be answered directly. But because it is in the keeping of an ineffable power, an absolute ability locked within the individual to achieve and become anything that he is resolved to accomplish that is right and proper. This also carries within it the opposite pattern, the perversion or prostitution of this internal power creates an inevitable corruption, which also must bring a sad and sorry consequence to the individual. Gradually, the motion of religions in the world, and Christianity in the foreground of these motions, the motion is the development of internal integrity. The individual must become that which he claims to believe. If he does not become it, his belief is nothing. And he will remain as he is now, sounding brass and tinkling cymbals, unless the belief that is in him changes his conduct. Now, this is one of the problems we have today, not only in the orthodox values of life, but in a great many mystical and metaphysical institutions. There are a great many groups that are still functioning on the power concept. They are thinking that some kind of a strange magic, some kind of a mysterious doctrine that has been handed down among a choice group from the beginning of time, enables the individual to become all-powerful without becoming virtuous. Now, this is perhaps fortified and supported by the rise of dictatorships and tyrannies in the world. There have been powerful persons who were not good. There have been great changes in history brought about not for the benefit of man, but to advance the glory of individuals and to exploit human nature. So that it is very important for the modern mystic, Christian or non-Christian, to realize personal responsibility in the practice of faith. If this responsibility is not accepted, the ends to be achieved are not accomplished. I have known a great many cases, several that I have very closely known, of people who joined organizations and were bitterly hurt. These organizations promised them a kind of enlightenment that would carry them successfully through life, would add to prosperity, would make them successful in business, add a little wealth here and there, overcome all the debilities of character, and perhaps even the debilities of health.